Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Delighted to be back with Germinal G. Van once again, the author of 80% of all the books that have ever been written. He also now has his own publishing company, the GGV Publishing Company. And I've interviewed a couple of authors who have published with him. In fact, at least one person published with him because he found out about Germinal's publishing company through the Tom Woods Show. So all good things. And I'm a little discombobulated right now because I just sat down. Like I raced in the house. Germinal doesn't know that. I raced in the house because my daughter had her driving test today. She passed, I'm glad to say. But I had to take her because I'm the driver in the house. And I rushed to eat some lunch and I raced up here. And I think I'm more or less coherent enough to be able to talk to our dear friend Germinal. So welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Now, we want to talk a little bit about your own life and some of your personal experiences that are going to be very interesting to people. But before we do that, I want to say something about a book of yours that is not yet released, but is on the verge of release because the subject matter, there's a teensy-weensy chance it might be of interest to people listening to this show. So tell me, what's it called? And I bet from what it's called, we can figure it out.
Yeah, so the book is called Thomas Sowell, A Misunderstood Economist. And it's a short intellectual biography of Thomas Sowell. And it focused more on his ideas and his writings more than his personal life. There is, of course, one chapter dedicated to the major events of his life. But the whole book essentially focused on his major ideas and how he shaped society, despite having a very limited reach in the mainstream media. So the premise of the book is to show how impactful he has been and misunderstood by most people, by those who pretend that they understood him but disagree with him, and to the people who don't know him and made an opinion of him without knowing him.
But that happens to us all. It's incredible. You know, they haven't read a word you've written, but boy, they know everything about you, they think. So, all right, so that's very good. So we'll look forward to when that comes out. And I remember when he announced, however many years ago it was, that he was retiring from his syndicated column. I was very sad. I had read his newspaper column ever since I was in high school. And it was perhaps a reminder of my own mortality when Thomas Sowell now is discontinuing his column.
Yeah, especially that, you know, it's pretty much at the twilight of his life. And I felt compelling to write this book because it's really personal to me. Of course, I never met the man, but he has always been my intellectual mentor. And I got to say that his writings have deeply shaped my vision of the world and the way I think. So if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be the person I am today, to be honest.
All right. So I want to go back. We've talked a little bit about this before, but I want to go a bit more in depth. You have a very interesting and unusual story. So it's not unusual for somebody to be an immigrant to the U.S., but a lot of the rest of the story is unique. So you moved from the Ivory Coast to the United States when you were younger. And so first of all, let's start there. First of all, how old were you when you moved to the U.S.?
I was 20.
Okay. All right. So you had much of your schooling already by that point. Mm-hmm. And the Ivory Coast, I presume, is the only country you knew intimately, right? Yeah. Only place you had lived.
Yeah.
So what would you say of your upbringing there? Because you mentioned that Thomas Sowell helped to shape who you are intellectually. Well, intellectually or any other way, in what ways did the influence of the Ivory Coast, is that influence still perceptible in who you are?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I think it's all about the mindset. And the mindset is very, very different. So Ivory Coast is a country that was colonized by France. So they have a very specific mindset related to not just friends, but the Roman language culture. And back then, in order for you to be in the upper echelon of Ivorian society, you gotta be in the political class. Even though, let's say you own a business and it's doing pretty well, for people there, it's not like a real sign of success. There, the sign of success is being part of the bureaucracy, being part of the administration. So back in Ivory Coast and even in most French-speaking countries, we praise people who have diplomas like PhDs, who are part of government and make laws and stuff like that. But then here in America is the complete opposite. And in most English speaking countries, here we believe that those who guide civil society are entrepreneurs because they actually take the risk to create a product or a service. And they know that it may not work. And they still put that on the market and let the market decide whether what they created is worth it to use or not. And when you do that way, what you realize is that you use, in fact, your productive capacity to change society, to add value to society. But back in Ivory Coast, it's more like you're part of the government. You're not really create anything, but your personal life change. But you're not changing the life of others in a positive direction, in my opinion. But that was the thing that I grew up with at first. Like, you got to be an intellectual. I do enjoy intellectual activities, of course. I read a lot. I own a publishing company. And what we do specifically is publishing nonfiction and academic work. So I'm really into intellectual activities. But I realized that that is not necessarily the way to provide value to society, especially here in America. After reading Thomas Sowell and other prominent libertarian scholars, it opened my mind about how economic power is much better than political power.
What languages are spoken in Ivory Coast?
French.
So how did you learn English?
So I lived in Kenya for a little bit, for 4 years. That's where I did my junior high, but it was a very challenging time because I did not know any English before going to Kenya. So I learned it on the spot. So it was very challenging. I lived in boarding school with my sister, to just the two of us. So we learned how to be quote unquote independent. So basically I kind of grew up without my parents. So I lived there for 4 years and that's how I learned the first words of English. And then I moved back to Ivory Coast in 2005. So I was in Kenya from 2001 to 2005. Then I moved back to Ivory Coast in 2005. That's where I did my high school. And then once I graduated high school, I came straight to the United States for college. I didn't even come here to visit, no tourist visa, nothing. Straight here to come to school.
So what age were you when you were in Kenya?
So I moved to Kenya when I was 11 years old in 2001. And I lived there from 2001 to 2005. So I moved back to Ivory Coast when I was 15.
What would you say was the most effective method you used to learn English? Some people say they watched a lot of English TV.
Well, yeah, that's definitely one factor. This is a factor, but also interacting with people. Just like talking to people and listening to the words they use, especially related to the context. That's even how my English improved in the US, especially like the first 2 years. I would listen to people and they would use words that I wouldn't use. For example, like I remember when I came and I want to take the elevator. I said, I'm going to take the lift. But here we say the elevator, or like, I'm going to put my trousers. Here we say pants. So it's those little words that actually make a big difference. And of course, the context also matters. So it's based on that my English really improved once I moved here.
I mean, those kinds of mistakes, you don't really have to worry so much about, because in the U.S., we understand what you mean by trousers, even though we don't really say it. We might laugh at you, but at least we can understand you.
Yeah.
The problem with a lot of languages is the speakers of the language are speaking too fast, or they're not articulating the words properly. So, you know, what ya gonna do does not sound like what you studied in your book. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
And if you're expecting to hear somebody saying, what are you going to do? You're never going to hear that.
Yeah.
So getting used to the way people speak in the real world is often frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's also the most effective way to actually learn, because I always had that mindset of learning on the spot. Like you learn as you go. I'm not very much of a learner from books, although I'm into books. I read a lot, as you can see. But I'm not the type of person to learn, then apply. I just go in it and I apply as I learn.
So what were the circumstances in which you left Ivory Coast for the U.S.? Why and how? And did you go by yourself? Did any family members come?
Okay, so in Ivory Coast, the baccalaureate is perhaps the most important exam for anyone in high school, because first of all, if you don't pass that exam, you don't go to college. And it's an exam that literally changed people's lives, specifically for those who have the resources to study abroad. That is the promise that their parents tell them. Like, you know, if you successfully pass your baccalaureate, you will go study abroad. You will study in France or where, or whatever Western country you want to go. So I always wanted to study in the US. I always wanted to live in the US, to come in the US since I was like age 10. And I don't know why, but back then I was already drawn into American culture. Although back then I didn't have any like really deep knowledge of American culture. So my dad asked me, okay, once you pass your exam, you want to, which country you want to study? I definitely didn't want to go to France or to any French speaking countries. I'm like, nah. So it was either England, if I want to go to Europe, or perhaps Canada or the United States. But I was so focused on the US. I said, I'm going to come to the US no matter what. So I passed my exam and then I came here. So I passed my exam on July 20th, 2010. And then in August, I came straight here. So we went to Tanzania. That's where my dad used to live because he used to work in the UN, at the UN as a prosecutor. So I got there for a few weeks. We went to the US embassy, did my visa. And then the week after that, we took the plane straight to the US. So he came with me. And then we got here and then it was like, okay, man, you're on your own now. That was it. No uncle, no auntie, nothing. Just me in Washington, D.C. I didn't know anyone.
How do you start from essentially zero in a whole new society?
Well, I've been always drawn into adventure. So I thought it was really exciting. Yeah, I thought it was like really exciting. I didn't know anyone. It was a completely new culture to me. Of course, I was homesick at first for the first 2 months. And then once I started talking to people and I saw that people, they were really intrigued by my accent and where I came from. I'm like, why not take advantage of that?
Yeah, sure.
I started to immerse myself in American society. And on top of that, I've always understood that if you want to rise the upper echelon of any society you live in, especially in a land that is not your land, you gotta associate yourself with the locals. And one mistake I see a lot of Africans make when they come in the US or any Western country is that they love to hang out with themselves and they don't immerse themselves in the culture of the country they live in. And it becomes a real problem when they try to get a promotion, specifically positions of management. Because when you want to manage someone or like a team of people, you need to understand the culture. You need to understand their mindset, how they do things. But if you hang out with your own people the whole time, there is like a ceiling that, you know, you cannot go above. So that was one thing I always understood. So I, on campus, I started to hang out with Americans. I rarely hang out with Africans there, although I have African friends, but I always made sure to be with Americans because that's how you move forward when you live in the foreign land.
Do you think by the time you got to the US, your English had reached its highest point, or do you think it continued to get better as you hung around with Americans?
I know it continued to get better. I knew that my English was no near the level it has today because I always look for improvement. I was like, okay, I had the basics, I had the structure, but I knew I was going to a country where the English is different than English spoken in England. So there were new words. So there were words that they were going to use that they don't use in England. And the words that they were probably going to use are different, especially in terms of context. So I knew that there was always room for improvement. So that's why I was like, that was a perfect opportunity to improve my English.
Everybody, Tom Woods here with another word on behalf of the outstanding Monetary Metals, where I have been very happy to have an account because I earn interest on my gold paid in gold. And I'm very happy to be joined today for this extremely brief mini interview with Addison Qualley, who actually works for Monetary Metals. How'd that come about? And I think you have a job where you actually really believe in what you do.
That's correct, Tom. Basically, I am the VP of relationships here at the company. I've been here since 2013, and I basically lead the sales department and help people come on board Monetary Metals and help handle their accounts. I've always been a big fan of freedom. Somehow along the way, was a fan of freedom just from high school. that really kicked up a notch when I started following your show in 2013. And I was working at a gold company at the time. I came to understand that gold is honest money and a very good thing. And when I learned about monetary metals back then, around 2016, it just seemed like something that could really change the world for good. If you can earn interest on gold and finance in gold, that is potentially world-changing, and you can get gold to come back into the monetary system. So that really excited me. I jumped ship from my old company. I joined Monetary Metals back then. And, you know, one of the exciting ideas we had in our head was, at the time, Uber was kind of taking out the New York City taxi cabs, and Uber had gone viral. And we thought if interest on gold, if earning yield on gold could go viral, maybe that could become a legitimate alternative to the dollar. We're excited to be growing a lot since then. The company's grown by leaps and bounds, and it's been a very exciting journey.
Well, I'm very glad to be able to be a very small part of it. So find out more and join me. Open up your own account with Monetary Metals. Head over to monetary-metals.com/woods to get more information. That's monetary-metals.com/woods. Now, when you say you came across Thomas Sowell and he changed the way you thought, we would all like to have more people have that experience. But number one, very few people read books like that. They just don't. Americans may, I don't know if that's true of other people in other countries, but they don't read serious books at all. So we're at a disadvantage, those of us who have views out of the mainstream, because people are just going to get their opinions from their surroundings or from television news or whatever. So it's great that you read Sowell, but it's unfortunately unusual. So how did you come across him in the first place?
So everything started when I got accustomed to libertarianism. So before I got into libertarianism, I used to be a strong Republican. I've always been a conservative Republican. I was never a Democrat or a liberal in modern political terms in America. I was always on the right. But when I started to learn economics, and I came first onto the writings of Hayek. So I learned about Hayek, and I was pretty enthralled. I was like, oh, wow, this is breathtaking. And then I was like, okay, I want to get politically involved. So I became a member of the Libertarian Party of Illinois, and then I got involved into the Libertarian Party of Chicago. And that's how we start talking more about Hayek, Mises, and Milton Friedman, specifically their economic views. And Milton Friedman, they talk about the Chicago School. And then I was intrigued by it. So I said, okay, who are the members of the Chicago School? Especially I live in Chicago. So I was like, okay, I'm going to look them up. And that's how I got onto Thomas Sowell, this black economist. Never heard of him before. Who's this guy? And then I look at his books online and I came across Basic Economics, Wealth, Poverty and Politics, Conquest and Cultures, and his other stuff. And I was like, oh my God, I need to read this guy. And then I started watching Uncommon Knowledge. It was after watching Uncommon Knowledge with Peter Robinson, in pretty much 40 minutes, Thomas Sowell convinced me. I was like, oh my God. And I did not know this for more than 20 years. I was like, at first I was like ashamed, because I was like, how I could not know this? Because it explained things so simply, and it was just based on logic, but very analytical. So that's what Thomas Sowell did. Like, he shaped my mind in terms of thinking analytically, always think in terms of incentive. And that was one thing I used to not do before I got into economics. And that's what economics gets you to do. It gets you to look at people in terms of incentive and self-interest. Self-interest doesn't mean it's a bad thing. Doesn't mean that selfishness is a bad thing. It's just like people act out of self-interest. Even when we act selflessly, the selfless act, in fact, is not because you're so good. It's just like you decide to prioritize the self-interest of someone else above yours. That's all it is. But even when you prioritize the self-interest of that person, and when that self-interest is fulfilled, you feel better about yourself. So your self-interest is still fulfilled. So that's how I started to understand why and how people act. And that's how I got into economics. And then I started buying all the books of Thomas Sowell to study him. And what really got into me was his views on race. Because, you know, the typical dogma is like blacks are at a crucial disadvantage because of their skin color. They can't go anywhere because the white man is preventing them from doing X, Y, Z. And then Thomas Sowell is saying, nah, So you guys are talking about the legacy of slavery, but under slavery, actually, the black household had two parents and child being born within the marriage. But since we got rid of slavery, we got rid of Jim Crow. Not that it's a bad thing. Thank God we got rid of those things. But since we implement the welfare state, now you see a tremendous rate of kids being born out of wedlock. You see the black culture literally degenerating into the wrong direction. And that really stick with me. And since then, like, I would not say a disciple, because that's a little too much, but I became like a strong proponent of Thomas Sowell's writings and ideas.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the people you met when you came here. And in particular, there's a lot of commentary about cultural differences between Africans in Africa and African Americans. And what I want to know is, what were your, and say whatever you want to say, I don't care, but what were your impressions? Obviously, if I moved to a whole new country and I found three or four people who kind of looked like me, I might gravitate toward them. It's not like the only people I'd hang around with, but I would assume they have, I don't know, maybe some of the same perspectives I do, or maybe they talk a little bit the way I do. I don't know, but I would at least want to get to know them. So in your case, I assume the same thing happened. And in what way were, quote unquote, African Americans similar or different from the people you knew in Ivory Coast or Kenya?
Sure. So first, when I came, my dad told me, don't hang out with African Americans. That was the first thing he told me. He said, if you do, you're going to increase your likelihood to end up in jail or dead, because they engage into counterproductive behaviors. So I went to Catholic University, which is predominantly white schools. So I was hanging out with white folks all around. I rarely hang out with African Americans, because I was like, based on what my dad told me, I want to stay out of trouble. And then when I started to get more interested into the cultural differences, what I realized is that when Africans come in the US, they don't take the opportunity for granted, because they know that they have no choice but to work hard and succeed. But those very same Africans who stay in Africa, who, for example, never moved here, they would have adopted the same mentality as African Americans here. Basically, they take where they're from for granted. And that one thing I realized about African Americans is that here, they take, not all of them, of course. It would be wrong to say that it's every single one of them. That's not true. But most of them, they have like a mindset of complaining that the system is against them. They're not prevailing because the white man is doing this to them, because there's systemic racism. But I'm like, but how Africans who are also black like them are being successful? Because at the end of the day, yes, slavery happened here, but colonization happened in Africa too. You think colonization is honestly not that different from slavery. Colonization is, in fact, is the white man leaving his home, coming to our land and subjugating us. So it's not different. So I didn't understand, but I was like, but why Africans here are able to take advantage of all the opportunities available to them to improve their conditions. But you guys who are here, you have all, like, especially that you have citizenship, so you have access to certain resources that we don't have, and you're complaining. That was something I couldn't reason. I really tried to understand from a rational perspective, and I couldn't. And I came to the conclusion that victimhood is, in fact, a lucrative business model. Because when you complain about not having access to XYZ, you get compensated for it. So when you get compensated for complaining, why are you going to work hard? So that's a realization I came from. And reading about Thomas Sowell confirmed what I thought. So it was sort of a vindication from my understanding of African American cultures. Of course, like, and when you look at Black Americans who lean more conservative, like Thomas Sowell or Walter Williams or Shelby Steele, these guys are reprimanded by most African Americans because they say they don't think like the way they were supposed to as Black men. And this is one subject I want to dig into maybe later, is the fact that we try to correlate skin color with mindset. And I think that is what is holding Black people back, or holding them down, is that we think that because we're Black, therefore we have to think a certain way. I mean, logic is not for white people. Logic is not for Asian people. Logic is for everyone. If you adopt productive behaviors, you're going to succeed. But if you engage in counterproductive behaviors, you're not going to succeed. It's that simple. And people trying to think that because you're black, you should adopt a set of counterproductive behavior to ascertain your culture. And that's wrong, I think.
Well, let's ask about your own personal experience. I mean, we hear nowadays that the United States is a white supremacist society. So, which means that there is a bias that is absolutely embedded in the whole society, top to bottom. So what I want to know is, have you experienced anything that you would describe as quote unquote racist, that you've been treated differently, you've been treated with suspicion perhaps, anything like that? So, and it's okay if the answer is yes. I'm not trying to urge you in any one direction.
So let me tell you this story. I think it was last year, the coordinator of the Catholic University Alumni Association contacted me on LinkedIn to talk about my experience when I was at Catholic U, you know, and he was part of the Black Student Association. And during the interview, we were talking and he was trying to see if I experienced any racism or anything and how was it to overcome, you know, racial barriers at school. I said, listen, man, like all my friends were white. Every Thanksgiving, I was always going to a white household. They fed me. They welcomed me. They sheltered me. Every party I was going to, it was with white. They always welcomed me. I never experienced that. And the guy was like, okay, no problem. Well, I'll contact you later on to invite you to a panel. Of course, he never did because I didn't fit the narrative. But the point is to say that I never encountered that. I came in the US in 2010. I graduated in 2014, and then I went to George Washington for my master's. But between 2010 and 2014, those 4 years were perhaps they were the best periods of my life because I had a lot of fun. I felt welcome. I could go to any party, like people welcome me. Hey, Jamal, yeah, come on, man. Like it was never an issue. No one told me, oh, you're black, you're not allowed to be here. No one told me that, oh, you're inferior to us because of your skin color. On the contrary, I felt welcome. In fact, it was the BSA students who did not want to hang out with me because I did not fit their mindset. That segregationist mindset that, oh, we're black, like we have to hang out among ourselves. We don't mingle with the rest of the students on campus. And I didn't fit that. So I always had an issue with them. So of course, you know the insults. You're a sellout. I'm like, I don't know who I sold you to, but okay. You're a sellout. You're Uncle Tom. Back then, I didn't know what Uncle Tom means. I'm like, I don't have an uncle whose name is Tom, but that's fine. And they gave me other type of racial slurs, but because I did not fit the narrative. So in fact, it was the African-Americans who rejected me and not the whites. That was the part that I found interesting.
Yes, that is so interesting because, of course, it's the reverse of what we're supposed to think. I wonder, how do you think you have to speculate about, but how do we reconcile, on the one hand, the experience that you've had, and you've lived in Washington, D.C., you've lived, well, I don't know if you want me to disclose roughly where you are now, but—
oh, no, that's fine. You can.
You know, outside Chicago.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've interacted with people in different parts of the country, and you have not experienced that kind of hostility. How do we reconcile your testimony with that of people, you know, we see on social media claiming that it's a constant feature of life in America?
Well, first, it's important to understand how Black Americans think and Black people in general. We have a very collectivist approach to life. We tend to think that because we've been marginalized for so long, we've been oppressed, therefore, we got to stick together. So we prioritize the group over the individual. We think that, if you notice, like sociologists, when they talk about like Black people's struggles, they tend to think that all Black people have the very same problems. Not that they forget, but they ignore that the people within that group that you're saying that are the same problems, they're individuals first and foremost. That means that every single person makes choices according to their preferences and their values. So it's based on those that they're able to allocate their resources. So that's why even within a Black group, people don't have the same outcomes. But they treated us as a uniform group. No matter what your preference and values and choices are, we're all Black because we all have the same skin color. Therefore, we have the same problems and therefore we need a uniform solution that will work for all of us. And that doesn't work that way. And I think this is where the serious issue is. Whereas when you look at whites, for example, they never treat things like this. They always see from the individual perspective. That is because the individual is the primary unit of social consciousness. So that's how it starts. You start from the bottom and go up. But blacks, they start from the top and go bottom. And so when you do that, of course, like, you're going to generate some optimal outcomes. And that's one of the reasons why the black community is still struggling. And the only people benefiting from it, as Thomas Sowell always criticized them, are the black political elite and the anointed, the intellectuals, the writers, all these people who are promoting social justice and so on.
I want to go back to something you said before when you were deciding where you wanted to go. You absolutely ruled out the idea of France or any place influenced by the French. You just dismissed it out of hand, and I need to know why.
I hate French culture.
Okay, explain that. Why?
No, I deeply resent it because they're not pragmatic at all. They're all about abstract. I understand the part that it is important to have abstract ideas because we need the abstract to move to the concrete. But for the most part, they do not make that transition from the abstract to the concrete. They don't materialize what they think about. And that's number one. And number two, they are deeply resentful of entrepreneurship. And that is most for continental Europe too. But France is, I think, the pillar of resentment against entrepreneurship. They literally despise people who take risk. For example, Bernard Arnault, who's currently the richest man in the world, he's not praised at all for whatever he has accomplished. On the contrary, they say that he's a villain. They say that he's the one who's destroying life. How is he destroying life? He's employing all of you. If it wasn't for his company, you wouldn't have a salary to start with. That is one factor. And the other factor is just that French culture, yeah, it's not a pragmatic culture. It's not, they don't focus on trade. They don't focus on productive capacity. They prioritize the bureaucracy a lot. They prioritize political power a lot. If you want to succeed in French culture, specifically being praised, you have to be part of the French bureaucracy. You got to be part of the French government. You got to be a civil servant. You got to go to LENA, which is the École Nationale d'Administration, the National School of Administration. People who literally go there are guaranteed to be part of the French government. It's like here in the US, if you go to Harvard Law School or Yale Law School, you're pretty much guaranteed to work for the US government, specifically in the Department of Justice. It's kind of like that. But in France, this is what they praise. So they try to tell French people that in order for you to make it in society, you got to be part of the political process. And I don't think that's true. I think it's political power is negative power. It destroys, it constrains, it restrains. That's not how you lift people up. You don't lift people up through political power. You do that through economic power, through economic revolutions. That's how you do. And that was one of the reasons why I was like, I do not want France. And the last part is, in French society, it's extremely rare to see an African becoming a millionaire or a billionaire, unless he's an athlete or a singer. You don't see an African being a millionaire because he started a business. In America, you see that. You even see African becoming billionaires. Only in America, you can afford to leave everything you have back home and start it over here and still make it. But in France, they have that social ceiling that prevents you from going above.
I guess I didn't, not having grown up in a culture influenced by the French, I hadn't put all this together. I had just kind of generally assumed that there was this dumb European hostility to productive people. But I hadn't disaggregated the European countries enough, to emphasize the ones that need to be criticized the most.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, everybody, quick word from Woods here. It's my goal to have the best supporters program out there, better than anything on Patreon or anywhere else. Support the Tom Woods Show, and not only do you get entry into my No Censorship Tom Woods Show Elite group, but you also get the 16-page Tom Woods Elite letter mailed to your home every month. Who else is doing that? This is all new material, completely different from the emails I send, and it is red hot. My supporters also get invites to my murder mystery dinner parties that I've been holding around the country. I'll be adding more cities soon to woodsmystery.com. I hold these in penthouse suites at luxury hotels with a beautiful catered dinner. It's a ton of fun. I also invite my supporters to my annual Christmas party. And the higher up you go as a supporter, the more things you get. Some supporters even get a small gift in the mail from me every month in addition to the newsletter. So go check it out, supportinglisteners.com. You will not believe all the goodies at supportinglisteners.com. And my profound thanks to all of you. But now that you've come to the United States, you've been here 14 years. What, as you've observed it, has been the trend in American culture on these types of issues? Are we better in 2024 than in 2010 or worse?
Tom, that's a complicated question. The reason why it's complicated, because it depends on each perspective. From my perspective, for example, I think that I am definitely better off from 2010 to 2024 in terms of access to resources, because the more the years go through with the increase and expansion of technology, it becomes far easier for someone like me to have access to resources. For example, I started my publishing company in 2022. But thanks to the internet, the cost that I needed to start a company was extremely low. I started my company with $200. Imagine in 2010 and maybe before that, let's say in 2000, you want to start a publishing company, you will need a couple thousand dollars to start that. So now, like, the cost to venture into something is much lower, especially in a country like the United States, which encourages innovation and entrepreneurship. It is much easier to build a life here in the U.S. than anywhere else, in my opinion. That's why I always say that the U.S. is the greatest country in the world. Now, if you want to see in terms of economics, are we better off today than we were in 2010? Well, when you look at the way money is produced, when you look at the involvement of government in the production of goods and services, I think it's getting worse in that sense, because government has total control over the money supply, which is decreasing the purchasing power of ordinary people like you and I. We are forced to invest into capital markets and other financial markets to maintain the value of money. Today, it's tremendously hard to buy a home because money doesn't mean anything anymore. So in that sense, no, I don't think we are better off. In fact, I think we're worse off. The more we increase government spending, the more we let the political class spending recklessly. No, because we have children, and imagine college. If we want them to go to college, college now costs what? Close to 60, maybe 70,000 a year. In 2050, how much is it going to cost? Just for 1 year. It's ridiculous. So no, we're not better off as the years go when it comes to the way we deal with economic issues. But at the personal level, especially when you're an immigrant, yes, as we have access to technology, we have access to more resources. Yes, we're better off, definitely, compared to. And I think I even saw one of your posts on Facebook. I think it was like yesterday or 2 days ago, where you were talking about how we're better off today compared to our parents and grandparents, where life was even much tougher for them than it is for us. And that's why sometimes when people complain, I'm like, you guys need to stop.
Well, I understand people who are saying that house prices are very high and things like that. But that's a double-edged sword, because some people are happy when house prices go up because they say, well, I have this appreciating asset. And so that makes me better off. So like when housing prices fell around 2008, instead of being happy about that, people greeted that like Godzilla had returned. You know, like nobody said, oh, this is wonderful. Now housing will be affordable again. No, right. The government did everything it could to prop those prices back up. Yep. But I do understand that. I do understand, obviously, complaints about price inflation. But the point, as you say, about my Facebook post, the point I was making was, yeah, if you're going to try to live like it's 1957 in 2024, it's going to be a challenge for you. Yep. But given the technology and the opportunities that are out there, if you know what you're doing, 2024 is way better than 1977 or something. I wouldn't even consider that. But unfortunately, it's that no one, you know, in the 13 years you spend in the ideological prison camps we call public schools, teaches you anything about how to make your way in the world. They just push it off onto the colleges. Well, you go and continue this process for 4 more years, and then we'll see what happens to you.
Yeah.
But again, you're not prepared for anything. You're not does not even explain to you how, if you didn't want to just be an employee somewhere, what would you do? How would you begin? How would you identify a niche? No one has any idea. How would you use all the free resources available to you that our ancestors would have killed to have?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they do it on purpose. It's because if they tell you how to do it, you won't need them anymore.
Yeah.
And they will go into complete oblivion. So they need you. It's the same for a politician and political activist. They have to tell you that you're oppressed so that they're relevant. But if they tell you that, oh yeah, in order to make it, at least make sure you got a college degree or a high school degree, you know, if you can, and then go to maybe vocational school or something. Don't get kids out of wedlock. You know, always be on time when it comes to your first job so that you build experience and discipline and stuff like that. If they tell you those things that they know you can do it, they won't be relevant at all. So I think that in order for people to succeed, the main thing they got to do, it's quite simple. I'm not saying that it's easy, but it's simple in the sense that focus on what you control. I think that people focus on what they do not control. And when you focus on things you do not control, the result is anxiety, stress, and you feel like the world is falling apart around you. But when you focus on things you control, you have to make moves. You have to move forward because you have the control over that thing. And that's how I've always seen life. And that's why in this country, I was still able to, I wouldn't say that I make it, I've not made it yet, but I've still able to move forward to be better off than I was maybe even 12 months ago because I focus on what I control.
Well, I remember growing up and thinking that government programs had all these unintended consequences. And then I got older and more cynical, and I thought, but if the programs keep having those consequences, maybe that's the point of the programs.
That's the point of the program.
So obviously the government is not unhappy when people are dependent on it. That's the relationship they like between the people and themselves. No dependent people is ever going to give them any trouble.
Of course.
They're not going to give them a moment's grief. So now, I think a lot of people listening to this will admit that that's true, that they're perfectly happy when people are dependent. So now what's the other side of that coin? How happy are they when people are resolutely independent, when they are not tethered to the man, when they don't have to be part of the machine? How do you think they feel about that? You know, and then a lot of the world starts to make sense. People like us are not exactly celebrated in the world.
Yeah, and that's because independence requires responsibility. And responsibility requires delayed gratification. And people don't want to wait to derive pleasure from what they do. That's the issue. Because when you want freedom, and that's the thing that people completely ignore, is that freedom equals responsibility. If you claim that you're free or you want to be free, that means that you gotta take the responsibility that comes with that freedom. And the responsibility that comes with that freedom means you got to behave as a law-abiding person. You got to be responsible in the way you're making your decisions. And you got to wait to reap the fruit of your labor. Sometimes it takes time. Sometimes you will not see the result right away. I can say the same for my company. Like, it is challenging, do not get me wrong. I love the work I do. I love publishing authors that write great books. But I am looking for that big breakthrough that hasn't come yet. But in the meantime, I am still working diligently and I am patient until I reach that breakthrough because my goal is to be one of the biggest publishing companies in Illinois, publishing liberty-minded people like you, people, intellectuals, professors, people like even David Smith, like those guys who have a big platform and who are looking for a publisher. I want to be their reference. But this is something that takes time. But it is coming. There are a lot of liberty-minded people that are submitting their work. And to me, that is already something incredible because it shows that this guy from Africa, from Ivory Coast, is actually doing something right. Because if he wasn't doing something right, people would not come to him. I'm pretty proud of that, but I am still working to achieve the goals that I want to achieve.
If people want to know more about you and what you're doing, what would be the link you would send them to?
Oh, I would definitely give them the link. www.ggvpublishing.com. That's literally the link to go to. That's where all the books are published. That's where we have all the services. And of course, I'm on Facebook and Instagram. So they have time in Journal Jeevan and they can find me. My profiles are public. So yeah, anyone can have access to me. And yeah, pretty
okay,
much.
Okay, that's what we'll do. Now, I'll put these links up in the video description, also at tomwoods.com/2488. Well, we wish you the best of luck on the release of your 117th book coming out. And I hope it does well. It's an important guy with important ideas. And thanks for that and for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Tom. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.